One, two, three. One, two. So maybe we will start our exploration of Sanskrit language in terms of philosophy of language. Or we can say we can explore philosophy of language on the basis of Sanskrit language, if you like. Whatever way you like to see this subject. For me, it is not different either way. So I thought to present it in several sections. One section is etymology as such, because it's the foundation of language, which we do not value anymore in our philosophy of language altogether. There is no such thing as etymology. It's not viewed in a systematic way. It is always understood only in a partial way. So there is a parent of the word, some kind of parent, ancestor, which gave this meaning, but meaning has changed many times during the evolution of the language. So it has nothing in common with that parent. Therefore, it's not important what etymologically it is derived from, what word it is derived from, because it is never viewed in a systematic way. So once there is no such possibility to see it in systematic way, how the sounds are changing and the meaning is changing gradually, one cannot approach this subject meaningfully. So if you see all those dictionaries on etymology, Indo-European etymology, it is rather confusing. Confusing to the extent that you will never be able to make out what is what and how it is. Etymology went into the direction of allophones and allomorphemes and cannot really anymore deal with pure shorter definitions of etymology. Somehow the sound does not make it better. That is positively. It's a nice. Well, when we speak about negative things, we can speak in negative terms, make it more positive. But when we speak about negative things in positive way, it sounds more negative. It's also a strange thing about language. So double negation is, how to say, strengthened affirmation always. It works like this. So what I wanted to see is what Sri Aurobindo proposes for Sanskrit etymology, and he speaks not only about Sanskrit etymology, but in general about science of language on this ground. And he says that that the knowledge was revealed to him by Krishna of all the origins of languages. So he kind of saw the origins of all the words, where they are coming from what etymological roots. Now, when we use etymological etymons or roots or root ideas, these are all very approximate terms. And I would like to come back to that, what Sri Aurobindo is meaning by them. It's not that actually, there are no even definitions for these things. They are not defined yet in the science of language. Because the etymon itself is a parent of the word which came later, but it is not viewed in the system of etymons. The idea of system of etymons does not exist altogether as a meaningful one vision of language, where all the articulatory sounds are relating in a meaningful way. Does it make sense?
They all come from nothing.
The problem is here that any articulation which is made by us is psychologically defined. And that psychology of articulation is very subtle. We lost that science. We do not have it anymore. Some poets have it. They distinguish, as we saw last time in our course on linguistics, the difference between different synonyms. And they use some words saying that this is more applicable in this line, like huge ocean or immense ocean rather than big ocean. Yes? Big ocean would be less applicable to that image. What is the difference between big ocean and immense ocean and great ocean? It's etymological difference. We do not see it, we do not feel it anymore, but in the sound there is a different shift or different feeling or different color. Yes, varna. Varna defines that etymological difference. The sound, the beauty of sound, or the power of sound, or the sequence of sound. Everything matters. Rhythm, sound, accent. So that sound, original varna, has its own significance, which is very general, or meaning, which Aurobindo defines as the idea sound, sound idea, or etymon. We can call it etymon. Etymon from which many roots can be produced later. There are simple etymons in Sanskrit which have meanings, very general meanings, from which you can see the whole families of words and roots come into existence. And they all share similar significance. They change in colors and move into their kind of direction, create new contextual meanings. Yes? When we looked into the question of meaning last time, and we examining the whole, looking into the linguistic science of today, that we came to that there is no meaning as such, and Saussure came to the point where he could not define meaning, and it is not for him the signified, neither signifier, it is something else which comes from the value system unknown. And he spoke about semiotics, that there will be new science which will deal with those meanings in a proper sense, but nobody knows what it means. What are these meanings coming, and why they are defined by signified and signifier? Where they are coming from? You see, what Saussure did is interesting. He bypassed etymology altogether. He just dropped it off because it wasn't seen in his view. There is no language in the West which preserves that etymological system, only Sanskrit. Being a Sanskrit scholar, he could not even see it even there. Yeah? And you can see that we will look into Nirukta. Already from Nirukta's time, Yaska also cannot see the meaning in etymological sense. It's only Sri Aurobindo who brings it back to the etymology. Does it make sense, etymologies? Not yet. It will make sense. Now Sri Aurobindo speaks here, the true method of science. It's a well-known quotation. Is to go back to its origin, the embryology, the elements, and more obscure processes of things. From the obvious, only the obvious and superficial results. That's how our science or etymology is working today. The profundities of things, their real truth, can best be discovered by penetration into the hidden things that the surface of phenomena conceals, into that past development of which the finished forms present only secret and dispersed indications, or into the possibilities from which the actualities we see are only a narrow selection. And that's how we see our words. We know our words only in contextual meaning. We do not feel the etymon behind. We do not see the hear the vibration of the word which defines the meaning. When we say word table, what do we feel? We just remember the meaning of the word table. We are not creating this word from the sound. And sound does not indicate any tableness to us. Only in the memory or in the habitual usage of language, nothing more.
You're leaving out the Hegelian segment of development in that definition, where the meaning is the concept. And the word table means table because you have built up experientially a concept of that thing. And so with Hegel, the signifier and the signified are in a kind of mental space that is the meaning. That's the thing itself. It's transcendental.
By memory.
Yes.
By memory.
Yes, by habit. We are forming, that's what Saussure is coming to, the same thing, that there must be some value in the social living of human beings. By definition, it uses signified and signify in such a way to create or to come to in terms of... But this is what I think is contextual meaning, that concept. It is already meaning created in the manifestation, in the mind first, and then in the reality, in the physicality. So,
well, in Hegel, though, the reality is the transcendental, phenomenological concept.
Yes, in the mind.
The table.
Right. Stableness. It's the same what Bhartrihari will say.
So, what was first? The table or the verb's table?
There was something else first.
Neither one existed.
Yes. So if for Hegel it is that word which was created within the consciousness of man in the cultural and all other setting and means this table which is remembered as table, he doesn't, it's exactly why etymology is skipped altogether. It does not exist as a power which creates that concept. Now, according to Sri Aurobindo, there was a preceding stage to that where the concepts were created in the mind, which was coming from the word. And there is a very important one, traditionalistic story about Brihaspati and Indra, which is narrated in Mahabhashya, well-known story where Indra was the first student of Brihaspati. Brihaspati was the teacher of the divine word of Sanskrit, who was teaching Indra Sanskrit. So Indra was his first student. Indra, the lord of the divine mind, to create those concepts. Now Indra understood that he cannot finish his studies because the speech of Brihaspati was infinite, endless. It was always actual in its own sounding to its own time and space. So you could not really extract it from the environment or context in which it was truly sounding. So the context and the sound, so to say, the form and the sound were one. Now what Indra did, he understood he can't really master this language because it is endless. So he has to sit at his feet all his life and not finish his studies. He stopped his flow of speech, cut those sounds into grams, pieces, and created grammar. So grammar is a mental construct, which is using the sound, filling in into it, to express it in any environment or any context, whether it is fitting or not. So such categories came in like time and space and causality. These are mental categories.
This sounds exactly like Hegel, put in mythological terms.
Okay, I like it. But the point is here that there was something before. There was a Brihaspati before who was the origin of the word. And Sri Aurobindo speaks about this language that Vedic language is, the word is rather a parent of an idea. Parent of an idea. It's not the other way around. It is from the word that ideas were formed and created and fixed in the consciousness, in our usage. and then applied into particular context, and we know them now as contextual meanings. Now, if you look into the dictionary, just open the dictionary, you will see how many meanings are for each word. These all meanings are contextual. They are not direct. They are not central to the meaning of the word. If you take word yoga, for example, I use always yoga because it's all dear to us. So yoga has 150 or more meanings in Monier-William dictionary. And what are those meanings? Starting from yoking, uniting, using, producing, any particular meaning of this word used in any context, because the device of the etymon can be applied into any context and create any meaning. Now that is the word of Brihaspati. Now one has, it's a higher mind, by the way. This capacity to see it is not coming from the ordinary mind and not from the reason. Reason cannot catch it. Reason becomes bewildered by this. But if we can widen the horizons of this reason, we will see that the capacity to formulate any concept, any contextual meaning, comes from the varna, from the color of vibration of consciousness. And this vibration has a potential to create any construct in the mind, which was used by the mind and fixed by the mind in a particular form. And that is language. Language comes later. Language is a result of this working out of the mind. Make sense? So what Sri Aurobindo says, the profundities of things, their real truths, can best be discovered by penetration into the hidden things that, I read this already, yes, narrow selection. A similar method applied to the earlier forms of human speech can alone give us a real science of language. Now, I'm leading to the same goal, to see how we could apply it and how we could widen the horizons of our thinking, that it could give us a real science of language. Not of thinking, but of language, of that which is filling thinking with its color or with vibrations which are meaningful and can be used by the mind in whatever way. Law and process must have governed the origins and developments of language. This is what mind does. Given the necessary clue and sufficient data, they must be discoverable. It's a good news. We can go back to them, to the depth of it. It seems to me that in the Sanskrit language, the clue can be found. The data lie ready for investigation. So this is my leading remark, because on this ground I wanted to look into the philosophy of language through the Sanskrit language and what it offers us. Now Sri Aurobindo defines this capacity, psychological and linguistic, how they kind of constitute one approach to language. In the Origins of Aryan Speech, he says, we can find an equal regularity, an equal reign of fixed process on the psychological sides in the determining of the relation of particular sense to particular sound. This is a big thing to say. If psychologically it is definable that we have a correlation between sound and sense, then we have to look into it in psychological terms also, not only in linguistic terms. It's not only that this is nice sound and we all enjoy mantras because they are sounding good. No, we have to really identify what is there sounding good and why. What is the meaning of that sound? So I was offering once in our course the theory of transparent etymology. What is happening in Sanskrit, it's a unique language in some way, because you don't have such languages anywhere else in the world, where any word you take, the root is visible. For example, if I take a pen to write, It doesn't say to me why pen is to write. In the word there is no indication. I have to remember that pen is for writing. In the word there is no significance of writing. In the table there is no significance of the table in a chair. We do not know why chair is to sit, why table is table, why pen is pen, why pistol or rifle is rifle. We do not know. Or computer, it's closer to us because it comes from other language. Computing or putting even reminds something of that, collecting and rearranging data. But other things are very remote from the etymological sense. In Sanskrit, pen will be lekhani, which will tell us immediately this it's from root lik, or from which is, you see, lik is from rik. They are kindred roots, and there is also rik, and lik is to scratch, so it is a scratching thing. Asanam is a sitting thing. It tells us what it does. So in this sense, in Sanskrit, there are hardly any words where etymology is not clear or not transparent. So I brought out this theory of transparent etymology, because in that case you are aware of language, you know where it comes from. Even rik, lik, you can take other roots, kindred roots, like lich, to leak. And leaking and scratching, very close to the same movement, they are differently applied and have different context. And came to mean different things, but in the movement of Varna, they are in the same vision, so to say, in the same etymological field. They are not deviating from that field. They are adding to it some other additional meanings from the context in which they were used. So this depth of looking at language means that we are operating with language already in different terms. We are listening to the sound. We are creating from the sound. We are articulating language in the varnik sense. I would not say mantric, in the varnik sense.
I have a question. Any of the Middle Eastern languages like Hebrew and Arabic have a similar kind of...
Yes, they have.
Tracking back into the roots for all their words.
Themselves in their own system.
Yeah.
I will speak only on Indo-European languages for now. I would not take Semitic languages into account. But yes, Hebrew has, yes. They all relate to the roots, but they took, as we saw from our linguistic course, another system of symbolism. Yes, it was completely non-verbal system. It's only in Sanskrit we have it finally to look into, because before A, B, C, D, E, F, G does not explain anything in terms of articulation. So here, kakha gaghanga, it's an articulatory system, finally systematized, mentalized, and clearly presented. A, B, C, D, it's an unknown system. It comes from the Hebrew, from the occultism, from Kabbalah, from that what Moses brought to Hebrew, to his people, and it was later taken by Greeks, and later by Romans, and so on. But from that time on, we are unaware of language as articulatory system. It's only in Sanskrit we have that. That's why Sri Aurobindo says that in Sanskrit we can find data. Because it was still in that view of that data. All the language was created on that ground.
And if we have the clue, then of course we can also apply it to the other languages. That what happens to me more and more work in this sense.
Exactly.
Then you discover it very much in English, for example.
Yes.
Then you see behind there also there is a system, a sound system in meaning psychology, in developing languages.
Yeah.
I have just the sound reason there is root three, which is movement, you know, running, rushing, you know, raining, It is that movement, and then it takes different qualities.
Very true.
It can
very
be violent, or it can be smooth, or it has this direction.
This is very true. By the way, we didn't do this exercise, but if we do this etymological exercise with the English language, you will be surprised how far it goes, how deep it goes into the Svarnik, and how it maintains it, and not deviates from it, doesn't want to go away from that chosen, how to say, feeling of that varna. It maintains it. And even if it deviates in time, it comes back. And you can see in the historical grammar how it goes away and comes back to mean this, because it seems that Brihaspati's speech is still sounding there beyond. And the varnas still have their significance. These are not only tokens to indicate ideas, though we are using it like this. Still, language is an alive entity of consciousness and cannot be used only schematically as mind wants. Doesn't make good. Do you? For the poets, it's absolutely clear. But for people who are using this language in terms of, you know, application only, drawing pictures, because we are basically drawing pictures, we are not speaking to each other, we are not sounding the word. We are drawing schemes. And I did this exercise once in my life, and when I was studying linguistics in St. Petersburg University, I saw suddenly what syntax does. Yeah? Syntax is a scheme of within the language of mental categories relating to each other in a particular relation, like subject, object, predicate, and so on. Time, space, causality, manner, and so on. Duality, all the numbers, all the cases. Now, what I did once, just to compare, I wrote one story in Russian. I told you most probably this already. But this is an interesting exercise. You will understand what syntax does. One story and another story, absolutely of different kind. Yes, one story was love story, and another story was about chemistry or physics, and elements, how elements relate, and something like this. You can take musical also story, you can take any other story. But I followed the same syntax. Same relations, mental categories, how they relate. You would not believe, I will make this exercise with you and we will look into it, what it does to our consciousness. You read first story, you understand it, yes. Then you read immediately second story, and it's kind of deja vu. You are like spaced out. It's the same, but it is different. So we understand what we say nearly on that ground, on syntactic ground. We are drawing pictures. We are not listening to the meaning of the word. We are not even we do not even know that it exists. We are absolutely mental beings.
That's the meaning of grammar.
Right. Exactly. It's the meaning of grammar. Syntax is grammar, is language. So, we trace this language in our mind all the time and think we understand. But we don't. We don't hear the word. We don't know what it means. So the word comes from somewhere else. It vibrates, it brings some meaning into it. That meaning is lost. That's why Saussure went for other meaning in value system. He thought it will be found there because etymology is lost. But etymology is the meaning. It's only very difficult to trace, to find, because you have to widen the horizons of the mind and to enter into domains of a higher mind. And there you will see, as Taittiriya says, thousands of the aksharas sounding in the highest heaven. This is the explanation of speech. The explanation of the word that thousands of aksharas are vibrating in the highest heaven. Our consciousness is charged with those vibrations. And they are articulated through our articulatory device here, in psychological sense, and get their contextual meanings. Now, once contextual meanings are fixed, our mind operates with them as it wants. And that's what we think language is and meaning is. But the whole upper part disappears. So the theory of transparent etymology, some basic views I wanted to present to you today, And that would be the first session. Later we will go to syntax and I will show you how Sanskrit arranged time and space, linguistic time and space. It's very beautiful and very clear in mental terms, and so on and so forth. Now, Sri Aurobindo says about Sanskrit language, he defines all these varnas, and I have to look into them for the first time with you, because you will find it very creative and interesting. The four first simple vowels, A, I, U, Ri, of Sanskrit language, indicate the idea of being, existence. Now, these simple vowels indicate the idea of being. Look how beautiful it is. Already you feel the philosophy of language is so profound, because these are not consonants, these are vowels. And vowels have very particular quality. They sound, this is the vibration of vocal cords, they have no articulation, but they have a texture. This texture is there. So A, in its short form, indicates being in its simplicity, without any farther idea of modification or quality. Mir, or initial being, creative of space. Because A has no articulation, when A sounds, there was no involvement of apparatus to create it or to modify it. There is no I, U, Ri, all this where tongue is involved or lips are involved, already modulations of A. So unmodified A is that initial being, indicates in its simplicity the modification without any further idea of modification of quality, mir or initial being, creative of space. Now I is another, it's already something else, an intense state of existence, being narrowed, forceful and insistent, tending to a goal, seeking to occupy space. These are wonderful definitions, because you will immediately feel what it does to us when we do this E sound, because when we press tongue to the top of our palate, E is the most forceful sound we can create. So A, which is sounding of the vocal cords pressed to the palate, to the top. So the intense state of existence, intensity, power, being narrowed as it is narrowed by the tongue to the palate, forceful and insistent, tending to a goal like an arrow, seeking to occupy space. Now, these are important definitions because you will find them as varna in all Sanskrit roots which have E. You will see it.
You pronounce the vowels in an English way, or because it would be
in the vowel way.
Well, in Dutch it would be different than English, so I think it could be different in Sanskrit.
No, now I will come to this varna sport, what it means. That's what you are saying is something which belongs to the dvani, prakrita dvani, that which is natural sounding. For Dutch it is different, for Russians, for English, for Sanskrit, for everybody different. But in the consciousness of articulation, it stays the same. When you press your tongue to the palate, you will not get another E, whether you are Dutch or Sanskrit.
Symbols nowadays represent universal sounds. So I'm sure that you have in Dutch A, and I'm sure you also have E.
And you have many more.
So this is not English, this is called the International Phonetic Alphabet.
Right.
So it's beyond, just because it is beyond
the migration coming out from the human mouth.
Right.
We have the vibration which has a definition from the human sound, from the speech, or any.
When you start combining it with consonants, then you get the changes.
Yes, and also you may have allophones. Allophones is a very normal thing. Everybody has different vowels in different languages. You know, you have different from English, or Americans have different from even English. And those slight differences, they do not change anything, because these are allophones. I speak differently English. You can recognize my accent. English people can. But you reconstruct in your mind that particular articulation. You don't mind me sounding different, because you are not listening to my sound. You are listening to your articulation of that sound. Once you articulate it within your consciousness, you know what it means. Yeah.
See, like the sound from in the Sanskrit speech, it's the grouping of the alphabet. In between, other languages can have different emphasis, so they have different emphasis. But the basic in Sanskrit, ka, kha, ga, dha, na, one here. Cha, cha, ja, ja, nya. Cha, tha, da, dha, na. Ta, tha, da, dha, na. Pa, tha, ba, bha, ma. From inside, sound is coming out. Other language, other human society, they can have something in between, some variation in their speech. But this is one definition, which we can call scientific definition, because that part relates to any human mouth. We put the tongue there, the same sound will come out.
Yes, well, it's a varnasphota, what is called varnasphota, that means the articulation in the mind of the sound. Yes, because when you apply tongue in the particular position, you may have variations, allophones, but what you articulate is common for all of us. What you want to articulate, I will recreate it within my mind. Does it make sense?
More
no,
less.
It will come.
Not completely. Like, I'm thinking about mantras, then the pronunciation, well, I'm studying this pronunciation, is very important, so I was...
No problem. If you pronounce in Dutch way mantras, the gods will hear you. Don't worry. There's no problem with that.
Are you using the lamp? Can you put it down?
This? All right. Yes, sure. Sorry. So, what I wanted to say also, that these varnas, they are psychologically relating to our states of consciousness. When we make this effort to pronounce this E, yeah, it's not only E what it sounds, but also the state of in which we are articulating that sound is important. It's a subtle state which brings that particular vibration into the system. If we would have an apparatus of dolphins, we would have different articulatory device, and we would not sound E anymore. There would be another effort made, there would be other E coming into the creation, into the speech. I want to say that these A, E, U, Ri are creation already, are creations of Indra. He made them, the divine mind, applicable to this apparatus. It is not that E is always sounding there. It is not the E which you will hear in that plane. It is that possibility to articulate it within this apparatus in that manner that you will hear there. It's a subtlety which I had to bring in, because otherwise it looks like many people think that the same sound is there fixed and we just get it down. No. If we would have different apparatus, we would have different sounds coming down. But they would be the same in that subtle space.
So that's why they can say there are 1,000 aksaras.
Exactly.
Because they have only 50, so,
right.
So that means it's not a metaphor, it means there are so many sounds.
There are many, many possibilities of these psychological articulations. We articulate meanings, we don't articulate sound. Articulation of meaning is sound. In the varnic sense, not yet in the contextual meaning sense, as applied to the creation. Varna, the state of consciousness. So this E is this intense state, than U. U, a wide, extended, but not diffused state of existence, being medial and firmly occupant of space. Look at this definition. How it adds to those two first. First initial being with no definition, then intense state of being, and then wide and extended state of being, of U, medial occupant of the space. Now, you will see that in Indo-European languages, all dualities are with U, dualities, yes? Dva, va will be there. Two, also you, second person, thou. Everywhere U will come in because the duality is to be marked by this U. The relation between me, subject, and you, as a second person, would be having that definition. In Sanskrit, you will find everywhere this duality as au, as you remember, marut marutau marutaha, devah devau devaha. It's a normal practice of this au as duality, and even in a locative sense, if you take agnih, you go agnih agni agnayaha, agnau, into the agni. So duality as entrance into the space and occupying the space, locating within. Even E changes to au. The U has to be there. It's not a casual thing. Yeah? It is. It may be seen like that, but it is supported by this vision of Sri Aurobindo of varnas, which create these etymological roots. If we take all of those roots, we will see everywhere it has this particular significance where U is used. Any of those. I will take later for you, with you, several roots which we will examine and see these significances. Now, you see clearly here three major definitions. A, state of being, undefined. E, intense state of being as a power. U, expanded, extended state as a... So what does it remind you before I come to Re? Did you see this sequence before?
It feels like elements starting A with Akash, E with Y, U with the light of the sun going into space, and
this is very, very first vision. Yeah, but do you have some other associations? I would not associate it like this. I think it's beyond that. But let us keep it for now. So, do you hear any other? You don't see these Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. You don't see this state Sat, Chit, Ananda. These are these. This one undefined state of being, then there is very powerful, forceful, intense state of being, yes? as Shakti, and then you have this diffused, occupying state of being, Mahalakshmi, or Ananda. Sri Aurobindo says it is infinite, Ananta Brahman, Ananda. And Dhri, a vibrant state of existence, pulsing in space, being active about a point within a limit, Mahasaraswati. Working out the details of manifestation, working on the point within the limit, breaking through, polishing it, you know, chiseling it, making it perfect.
Sri.
Yes. Rrr, vibration. It is the, again relating to our apparatus, this vibratory state, working upon the point. That's what we experience when we pronounce this sound. That's why all those words in Russian or English, breaking, you know, crushing, they will have R within itself, because that is exactly where the sharpness of this kind of application comes. Russian, all Russian words are the R for breaking. Yeah? There is one more sound which Sri Aurobindo does not refer to is a li sound. And it's quite interesting. Panini compares ri and li, and he says that they are of the same kind, and he would not distinguish between them. And it made me think that if they are of the same kind, that there must be some deviation from ri into li, like rekha, lekha, yes, rik, lik, lekhati, rekhati, scratching, but then it becomes lekhati, l. So this change is very common in Indo-European languages, from r to l.
You mean that replaces the other?
Yes, they replace the other. But there is, in l, there is something gliding, or leaking, or, you know, laughing, or sliding, or, I don't know, plowing, if you want. There is something in it which is also movement, but already softer movement. Yeah, touching the surface rather than breaking it through, as it is with ri.
You say you realize that your tongue is in the same place in both, mm-hmm. and the only difference is the touch.
Yes.
Tongue is moving the same way. So one is not touching, and the other is touching.
Exactly.
You can make one touch and the other one not touch also. It becomes very, it's a very subtle. So your ra can become a ra, and it can touch, and then it's almost identical to the ra.
In a Sanskrit language, la is identified with dentals and ra with cerebrals. So rrr, vibrating on those hills.
They're both palatal.
Palatal is upper, and this is cerebrals.
They're both right on the
lower palate. That means on the cerebrals, we call, yeah. Palate is that upper e where cha 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 nya. But these are ri and l. They already put l on the teeth, huh? When you locate them.
Huh? The gum and the teeth.
Yeah, and teeth. That's why it is called dental. But the point is taken very well, because Panini ponders upon this in this way. So he sees them kindred sounds. He doesn't want to distinguish between them. And it made me think that there was a time where it came into existence, because ri was different sound in the European languages, was this ri. Yeah? And Rig Pratishakya says a ri I li u. Not a I ri li u, but a ri I. So ri sound is located before I and after a. So it was this Rig Veda. It's already forgotten. Nobody speaks this way, only in European languages. So when it came to mean palatal, when it came to mean cerebral, there was a dispute. This ri became that li close to it, and he couldn't distinguish. It was in that time, historically speaking. That's why he was disputing that.
And sometimes shifted.
Yes. That's why Maharashtrians will say ru. Why they say ru? Because next vowel is only u after cerebral r touch, mm-hmm. whereas ri, why it is ri e pronounced, because it is before e in the Rig Pratishakya sense. So you have two traditions in India, two different Brahmanic traditions who are always quarreling how to pronounce Rig Veda or Rug Veda, Krishna or Krushna. This is going on up to now.
It's still going on. Yeah. Later time.
They came to Maharashtra after Saraswati River died. They are Saraswati. Saraswati Brahman came on the western coast to Maharashtra after Saraswati River died. Another branch went to Bengal, Lord Saraswati. So the origin is Saraswati. When the river dries up, they come to Maharashtra. So they always be late.
Yes, well, but that shift of the sound ri from velar sound, back tongue sound, towards Murdhaniya, towards the cerebral sound, was marked in the history. We can see from Rig Pratishakya to Taittiriya there is a shift. So somewhere in between that happened. But why I'm saying all that, that Li and the Ri are kindred sounds. Ri is more distinct and Li is more gliding. And because it is gliding, it belongs to the mental states. More mental in the hierarchy. If I see hierarchy, Sat, Chit, Ananda, Vijnana, and mind, Li. These are all vowels which are located in my view. For myself, I have this view. And I see the whole possibilities of meanings coming after that.
In Chinese, they don't distinguish.
Chinese, well, they don't sound... Their sounds are completely irrelevant to their writing.
Well, the sound Li in Chinese represents...
Ri and Li.
Ri. And it means this sort of original meaning. Sound, the sound and the meaning of the law, the right and the truth and so on, Li. Only it's pronounced Ri. So there you get also a reduction to a very pure association between that sound and this coming into existence.
Yes, it's a good example. By the way, the same with Korean or Japanese, it's so sometimes confusing to hear what they say, but it's Ri and Li, yeah? Leech, you know, leech, leech, rich, ah, rich. Leech. So, what I saw in this particular vision, that sound R was seen later already by tantric tradition as the basis. Abhinavagupta sees it as the foundation of all speech. And even Krishna says in the Gita, I am the sound A among all sounds. Why? Because it is not yet articulated. It is the substance, the color, which is white color, if you like. Yes, it doesn't have yet any other color in it. It's a white color. So why it is important to see, because in later in grammar you will see how it is used, this white color. If you paint on it, it is fine. It can take any sound. That's why Sanskrit is full of A sounds. Yeah? Vadati, yeah? Vadata. Everywhere these short sounds. Yeah? If you take any mantra, you will see how many A's are there. That's why they are not even marked in writing. Because syllabic writing, they are not even visible because there are so many of them. It's based on A. A is a carrier of articulation. But if you put A in front, like avadat, what it does, it either brings the negation or it brings non-actuality into it, as white sound does. Suppose you have a painting and then you paint it over with veil of white. You have the same painting, but it is non-actual. It's not fully in front. It's as if veiled. So avadat will be meaning spoke. Yeah, he spoke. It means he imperfect. He was speaking. That means it is not actual now. He is speaking not actual now. So that this negation, or you take negation in general sense, asatyam, yeah, or anaritam, or whatever. I use asatyam because it's better to use. Not truth, yes? There is no falsehood, or there is no lie in Sanskrit. It is always truth which is not actual.
Asana.
No, asana is longa. It's from root as, to sit. Yeah? Yes, but asatyam, what it is interesting here, when you say it's untrue, means that it is truth which is not actual now. Yes, you say the truth, but it is not applicable to this context. It's a very good way of seeing it, because the word cannot lie. It's the context into which it is applied wrongly that it lies. Yeah? But otherwise it would not lie. If you say you are clever or you are good or you are beautiful, it doesn't mean that it is a lie if it is in the context. But if it is out of context, it becomes something else. So this misplacement of context was done by Indra, the divine mind. He created categories in the mind. He captured the varna, the vibration of consciousness of Brihaspati, and he could apply it to any context. Now, the same word can be repeated, the same phrase can be spoken in any context. In Brihaspati's sense, it couldn't be done. He was true to the sounding of that word in that moment of time, if we speak in terms of time, or in that particular context. It was true because the word was true. Now it can be untrue, because there's already mind in between, which operates by categories and puts them into whatever context it wants. And this is the beginning of creation of all things. They are all misplaced in that higher view. And this misplacement, this shift, this tilt of the orbit of the sun creates this manifestation. And that myth from Mahabhashya is seen as a myth of creation, when Indra takes Brihaspati's word and puts it into his own mental context.
So he needs him actually to do the creation.
Yes. This misplacement is needed to manifest the divine. So this sound A was seen as a basis. I'm coming to the end of today's lecture.
Go to 5:15.
To 5:15, okay. We will have to order next time some juice, yeah. No, I have time. I just started, by the way. It was an introduction into etymology. We didn't look into anything yet, no roots, nothing. So this idea that A is not articulated color yet, and being articulated creates all other sounds, is very important. So A is present in E by the tongue pushing it to the palate. A is present in U by the lips focusing it and making that A, U, and so on. So this sound A is infinity of being, which is being articulated by this apparatus into different sounds and different meanings and different applications of consciousness. That has to be viewed once. Once you see it once, you will be always referring to it every time you want to deepen the understanding of the word. So I was even, it was many years back, I was thinking about defining it, if apparatus were different, non-human, then the sounds would also differ. In other words, specific sounds are only representatives of a specific articulation, or better to say, of a living and conscious attempt to articulate a specific meaning. Now this, all this living and conscious attempt to articulate meaning is leading to these varieties of expressions, language.
You need to change that word "than" to "then."
Yeah, can be. I don't see it even. Yes, then. Thank you.
Than the sounds?
Yes.
But it's interesting for me to know that the mind is already involved there. Sound.
Right. Varna Mala is already a creation by Indra. One should understand that. Because if you think that it is Brihaspati's thing, it's not true.
And
Indra is already.
Many people, when they work with sound, they might say it's no mind. It has nothing to do with mind, but it is already.
It is already. Very mental, clearly defined, demarcated by the mind as such. That's why it is possible to trace it. Otherwise it would have no meaning if there would be no mind there. So the Rishi's use of language, says Sri Aurobindo, was governed by the ancient psychology of the word. That's what we are trying now to understand, what it could mean. When in English we use the word wolf or cow, we mean by it simply an animal designated. We are not conscious of any reason why we should use that particular sound for that, for the idea, except the immemorial custom of the language, as we discussed before. And we cannot use it for any other sense or purpose except by an artificial device of style. But for the Vedic Rishi, Vrika means a tearer, and therefore, among other applications of the sense, a wolf. Dhenu meant the fosterer, nourisher, and therefore a cow. But the original and general predominates. The derived and particular is secondary. This application into particular context of that sounding, of that etymon, sound idea.
I see again a very close parallel with Hegel, because he was completely preoccupied with this duality. The general, which is the true, and the particular, which is removed from the true because of the necessity of manifestation.
Oh, wonderful, beautiful. So Vrika can have any other meaning also applied to a particular context where this necessity to tear, to break through, is to be expressed. The Vedic Sanskrit, says Sri Aurobindo about psychological method of the Veda, abounds in a variety of forms and inflections. It is fluid and vague, yet richly subtle in its use of cases and tenses. And on its psychological side, it has not yet crystallized, is not entirely hardened into the rigid forms of intellectual precision. The word for the Vedic Rishi is still a living thing, a thing of power, creative, formative. It is not yet a conventional symbol for an idea, but itself the parent and former of ideas. It carries within it the memory of its roots, is still conscient of its own history. Now, what is interesting here is that he says that it carries within it the memory of its roots. The word. And that is the system of etymons. Every word is amplified in the meaning by all other kindred meanings around. It's a very living system. It's not that it stands on its own. It has a support from the whole system. The whole system gives it this meaning.
It seems like root. In this case, it's not a linguistic root, it's a meaning root.
Exactly.
It's a more vast, general sense of meaning.
And yes. That's what you say, almost as if root is here at once. It just goes almost the longer we call a root.
In root, you know, force of the greater power.
Yeah. Well, I don't see the difference here, because when you look at it in a systematic way, as a system of etymons, you will see that it's like in the table of Mendeleev, chemistry table. Every element is defined and stabilized and understood in the context of all other elements, and not otherwise. Otherwise it has no meaning as such, or very little meaning. Does it make sense? That
so
all
the
roots
support each other, really. Not only that which creates a
right.
Roots.
Right. And we will go and see, most probably if we have time to see that, it would be nice to look into those examples. I will bring next time examples of different roots, and we will go through them and see how they create these contextual meanings and what they could really mean in themselves. Because it is not that which will be found in the dictionary. In the dictionary we will find only that which we find in the text used and interpreted by our mind and usage. Okay, so I think that's enough for today.
What program do you use to track these
actually,
accent marks?
Yes, I think I found them somewhere in some and put them here. I don't know.
I've been unable to find those.
You can take
somewhere.
This from here, yes. I can give you this and you can use them, paste and cut them in, and it will be useful.
Can you put them in on top of the word also?
No.
That's,
unfortunately.
That's what I'm interested
All right. So if you have some questions, remarks, something to say, you're most welcome.
Yeah? I'm reading the Guna, so you will come to that, because so when you talked about the A, then it was also clear, more as if A is behind all other vowels. And that's why also with A, all the vowels are strengthened.
Yes, one, maybe one can even look into this super quotation of Sri Aurobindo for the final thing,
yes.
Where he says that each word in the Vedic language had a general character or quality, guna, which was capable of a great number of applications and therefore of a great number of possible significances. Now, this is also the ability of the higher mind. From the higher mind view, it can be applied into any context and use any formation or any particular movement. But later, when it is crystallized, it becomes rigid in its application and can be used only in that particular context where it is found. Here it's still flexible. It is free from the contextual rigidity. And this guna and its results, it's shared with many kindred sounds. That's why all those roots support this root with their meanings around, so to say. At first, therefore, word clans, word families, started life on the communal system with a common stock of possible and realized significances. So they could kind of flexibly share those significances. And on a common right to all of them, their individuality lay rather in shades of expression of the same ideas than in any exclusive right to the expression of a single idea. The principle of partition was at first fluid, then increased in rigidity until word families and finally single words were able to start life on their own account. This is a beautiful vision.
Now you can see why he applies the concept of Darwinian natural selection to language, to his analysis of the Vedas. He actually uses that term in explaining this process of word families.
Yes, it's a good analogy. Because we are now moving into the philosophy of evolution, so it's a good transition.
And if or when we happen to become supramental, will there still be a language?
You could conclude that the process of natural selection comes from language, not from genetics.
Can be. There is no answer to it. No.
The human body is also already there when the word comes. Otherwise, how it can be expressed?
Exactly.
So mind is there and entering the body and illuminating the body. And the speech comes to man. So something about the evolution. And some process in the time.
Chomsky's idea is coming up.
Chomsky.
That we are evolving body and brain, and child is growing with the brain, and abilities of language are already there. And they are just seeking their expression or language by which it can be utilized. For in the first state of language, the word is a living or even a more living force than idea. Sound determines sense. In its last state, the position has been reversed. the idea becomes all important, the sound secondary. That's where we are now. So we are not in the Brihaspati speech anymore, but it doesn't mean that it disappeared completely. It is still influencing our ways of expressing ourselves, our thoughts, and that's why language is not going far away from its etymological roots. Cannot go very far. It can try, but it falls back every time. And there are these waves of going away and coming back and going away in the history. If we would see these waves, we'll see how it is seeking for its boundaries somewhere there and comes back, falls back into its own etymological framework. So the words in Sanskrit language were far from simply symbolizing objects and the relationship between them, as they mainly seem to do in the modern languages, derived from their own system of seed ideas. They were revealing quality, power, and state of existence within their own system of meaning. Not only what is happening outside, what they indicate, but also within their own relations. Within that system of meanings, they have these subtle relations, which determines that poetry. In the very source, they were not to imitate or project outer reality as words are supposed to do by modern linguists, but to reveal the inner reality of the word and thus to create a new outer reality. So there are there is a reflective speech and there is this creative word which relates to itself, to its own source. This was my first long from university paragraph. I can see how it changed already from that what I was thinking that time. But still, it is that thinking which is valid to see that we have two words. One is related to its own source, to the etymological system, and other which is reflecting outer reality and deals with outer reality all the time. And they are both always corresponding, like vertical and horizontal consciousness in us. Anyhow, for now it's all that I want to say. So we end today and we go. We have 15 minutes break and we are having the philosophy of evolution 2 by Rod. You would need a computer?
Yeah, can you pull up the website?
Oh, no, not on this computer, on that.
It's okay, I have it in my...
You have it? We can put it. So we can have a break now.